right to restrict people's freedom based on race or ethnicity, a kind of discrimination that we reject in virtually every other context. We reject domestic racial segregation and racial discrimination, or at the very least, we say there should be a high presumption against it. And the reason why is because race and ethnicity are morally irrelevant characteristics that people don't have any control over. Whether you're Black or white or Hispanic should not determine how much freedom you have. It doesn't determine what kind of a person you are. And similarly, the same thing should be true of whether you're born in France or born somewhere else, or whether you're Chinese or Anglo or whatnot, that these are also morally irrelevant characteristics. And if we reject using them to restrict people's freedom domestically, I think the same thing should be true internationally as well. The other type of objection that is often raised against freedom of movement is an objection that says that a nation is analogous to a homeowner or to a private club, where the current owners have the right to exclude other people as much as they want for any reason, because just like I can exclude people from coming into my house. This analogy is very commonly used, especially in the US, but it has serious flaws of its own. The biggest is that if you take it seriously, it has dire implications, not just for immigrants, but also for natives. Think about how a private homeowner has the right to suppress speech in his or her house that they don't like, or to suppress religions that they don't like. Only the religion that I like can be practiced in my house, for example. If a government has those same rights, it could suppress freedom of speech, freedom of religion, virtually any other liberty that it disapproves of. So this suggests that it's just wrong to analogize nations to clubs or to private homeowners. Finally, there are many people who argue that what we need to do is restrict migration, not because there's a general right to do so, but because we want to prevent negative side effects, such as overburdening the welfare state, having immigrants come in who vote for bad policies or bad politicians, and many other examples. In the book, I go through a large number of these. Here, I will just go through the general framework that I try to use to address them. So I would want to ask three questions. First, how big is this problem really? Often it turns out that it's not much of a problem at all. For example, it turns out that nations with more immigrants as a percentage of the population don't actually have higher welfare spending per capita than those with fewer. Often they actually have lower, and so there's not really much of a danger of overburdening the welfare state. But let's say that it really is a genuine problem. In that case, I would want to ask, is there a keyhole solution? That is there a way that we can address the problem without actually excluding people? Usually, in most cases, there is. For example, if you worry that too many of the wrong kinds of immigrants would vote for bad politicians or bad government policies, you can do more of what we already do, which is that we don't allow immigrants to become citizens for at least 5 years. And even then, they have to take a civics test that most native-born Americans would fail if they had to take it. So we can use measures like this to deal with the problem. Finally, to the extent that there is a problem and keyhole solutions can't fully address it, we can tap some of the vast wealth created by migration to address it. I mentioned before that free migration throughout the world could double world GDP. Similarly, expanding foot voting within countries can make people much more productive as well. We can tap that wealth and spend it on mechanisms that can address potential negative side effects of migration. For example, if you worry that this will displace native labor or reduce its wages, a problem that's overblown, but let's say you worry about it nonetheless, you can tap some of the wealth and use it for additional wage subsidies for whatever native-born workers you think are unfairly disadvantaged. The last point that I will make is that while most of these objections, at least today, are traditionally raised against international migration, if you take them seriously, they apply to internal migration as well. If you think that the U.S. is a club that should be able to exclude people, why not the state of Texas, so that people like Sandy Levinson could perhaps exclude migrants from California that they may not like? Similarly, if you think that migrants from abroad should be kept out because they might overburden the American welfare state, then similarly, migrants from a poor American state might overburden the welfare state in a wealthy one. If you worry that immigrants will increase crime, immigrants from abroad, than migrants from West Virginia to my state of Virginia, they might increase our crime rate because West Virginians on average have a higher crime rate than Virginians do. So if you really take these objections seriously, then you would have to want to restrict internal migration severely as well. Much more can be said, and I look forward to Sandy's insightful comments and to Tim's presentation and to the Q&A with the audience. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Professor Selman. And now we will move to Professor Waters.
Thanks very much. And I wanted to start with reiterating the thanks to the LEC and to George Mason Scalia and to IU Maurer for organizing and hosting this. It's really been a great effort. And also advanced thanks to Sandy Levinson for commenting on it. So you just heard from Professor Selman. We've got very different approaches, but they do share some commonalities. One in particular, as a general matter, is they're both looking to challenge what are rigidities in the broader system of how we organize politics in our societies and between them. Professor Soman's talking about the advantages and disadvantages of people moving. I'm going to focus on something else, which is ways in which people might stay where they are, but move the units, change the borders that surround them where they are. Now, this goes, as I say, this challenges an assumption that's very core to our post-war order, which is the idea of territorial integrity and the assumption that rigid fixed units are actually a great idea, that they're stabilizing and that they limit violence and actually shape political participation in positive ways. I want to examine and challenge that assumption. My question is, what if borders are in fact are the problem? What if they cause instability and it actually can increase violence? My project is basically to test that underlying assumption, to think about a way of examining it, and to do that by proposing a different rule or different process, one that would allow us to manage change in units and borders, and that one that is responsive to democratic politics. So I frame this as what I call a right, a democratic right to secession. What I want to do in my remaining time is sort of describe the rule we have now, the critiques and the assumptions that underlie it, and then very briefly at the end, outline my alternative model, which is a way of testing this rule. So a lot of this, I mentioned territorial integrity. I'm also going to talk a lot about self-determination. And for many people, this is an idea they often associate with Woodrow Wilson, the post-World War I period. And that's where we do see the idea first forming, the notion that people or peoples ought to, as a normative matter, determine the unit they live in. They ought to determine the shape of the state they live in. That's not the rule we have now. We are governed by a very different form of that principle since World War II that we can find in the UN Charter, which is also called self-determination, and says that all people ought to govern themselves, that they ought to do so in the units in which they live. This is a real reversal because the system, the principle we have, says that people should govern themselves, but that people are the population of an existing territory. Now, at the time, in the immediate post-war period, this looks like a radical sort of deconstructive principle because it was attached to, in the first decade and a half or so after the Second World War, attached to the principle of decolonization as a justification for it. So it really did become a principle that, in a sense, broke colonial empires. But once that project was largely outlined and completed by the end of the 60s, we can see that the kind of self-determination principle we have is actually really conservative because it preserves all borders. All the units that were states or territories or colonies in 1945 become states and remain so. It's such a rigid rule, in fact, that a leading scholar, Thomas Frank, once referred to it as an idiot rule. He didn't mean the rule was idiotic. He meant that the rule was so basic and simple in its operation that even people with limited faculties could operate it. And it really is true. If you took a map of the world in 1945 and a crayon and said to a little kid, hey, draw circles around all the things that are or will be states, he could get almost everything right. He'd get a few things wrong on the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia, but he'd be able to circle all the colonies and those would become states. And he'd have a map very much like the map of today. So the rule is actually quite conservative of territorial units. There have been what we might call recent developments in this field. There's been a move since the 1960s towards what we call internal self-determination. This is basically the intuition that if people should govern themselves, they also should govern themselves inside those units. So not just what we call external, having your own state, but the quality of the state inside. And we can see this in moves like the revival of minority rights, the move towards thinking about things like autonomy or federalism that Professor Soman mentioned, the rise of indigenous people's rights, and the move towards democratization itself. All of these are moves about the quality of governance inside the state, and we think of them as internal self-determination. They're all fine moves. One thing to note, they're all, in a sense, an alteration of the original claim that there was a right to create a new state. They're all what I call like a deconstruction of self-determination. We have more and more peoples, like indigenous peoples, but they don't have a right to form a new state. All of their rights are inside the existing units. And we find almost no traction for the idea that we should make new states, whether or not populations might desire it. And as I say, there are some reasons why we think this is a good system. And I've sort of discerned three basic assumptions in the literature and in the practice of states and diplomats. And those are basically a commitment to stability, a belief that if we were to have a more relaxed rule, we'd have endless new states and fracturing that would lead to violence. We also have an assumption about process, that we think if we were to relax borders, that would lower the incentives for groups, minorities in particular, to cooperate inside the state. And the third is a kind of a value commitment, which is a belief that secession will likely create illiberal states and that we don't want that. So these are the three assumptions I want to look at very briefly. They're really hard to test, by the way, because what we have is a global rule since World War II of territorial integrity. It's really hard to test how that's actually working. But we can make a few observations as to why these assumptions might not be quite as robust as we assume they are. First, on the idea of fracture, it's not actually clear that were we to relax the rules of new state creation, that we would have an endless fracture into more and more states, because there are also many integrative incentives in politics. If you think about something like the European Union, I admit this is not a great time to make this argument because one state is leaving, but many states have joined, others would like to. Over the long period since the Second World War, it's a tremendously successful integrative project in which many sovereign states gave up portions of that sovereignty for purposes of economic and social advantage. There are lots of reasons why states would join together for trade, for security. And it's not true that those incentives go away in a dangerous world just because we might have a right to make a new state. There's also a kind of normative assumption built into this concern with fracturing, which is, what is the right number of states? We actually have many more than we used to because of all those colonies that have been liberated, and it would be awkward to imagine that they shouldn't have become states. It's not clear that there's actually a correct size of a state. Smaller states on average are actually wealthier and more peaceful purely as a correlation. And I have to give you one wonderful anecdote here about fracture. When the Yugoslav crisis was breaking out in the early 1990s, the European Union sent a delegate, a representative, to caution the republics inside Yugoslavia that they shouldn't secede. They're hoping to prevent this process. And they went to each of the local Republican capitals, including Ljubljana in Slovenia, to warn them and say, look, you're not viable. You're too small. Well, Slovenia is a state today, but the real interesting note is who was sent to give this message that Slovenia was too small. It was the foreign minister of Luxembourg. Well, okay, let's move on. The second assumption had to do with concerns that minorities might not cooperate if they had a right of exit. And this is probably true. But what this masks is that in the current system, majorities have no incentive to cooperate with their minorities because the gates are locked and there's no exit. And this is basically game theory. If you were to run a game in which you had more than half the power, how to divide resources, and the other guy couldn't leave the room, you will predictably give him a pretty bad deal. But if he can exit, you'll give him a better one. So the fact that current majorities have no incentives to negotiate with the minorities is a feature of our current system. The third assumption we actually have some data on. This is the belief that secession leads to illiberal states. There's actually not a lot of evidence that this is true, because we can look at places like Slovenia or the Baltics. There's just no valence to secession leading to illiberalism. All it does is produce smaller states. I mentioned these recent developments, human rights, minority rights, and democracy. These are very good features that I favor, but they don't solve the problem of communities that feel alienated from their own state. each of them in their own way assumes the existing states as the unit that has to be fixed. So human rights, for example, even good rights-respecting states can have state languages, state religions. These are perfectly consistent with human rights, but they clearly pattern the nature of the state and its operations in favor of one group over another. Or democracy, which is a wonderful feature, but can produce sort of where there's an ethnic cleavage in a society, can produce kind of permanent structural losers whose only failing is not that their ideas aren't good, but that they don't constitute a majority in that state, which is only a function of the existing borders. The problem is all of these moves, human rights, minority rights, democracy, they all assume that the state we have is the unit that we have to have and have to fix if there's a problem in it. But demographics are actually quite fluid, so it's not clear why rigidity should be the best response to it. We tend to see secession as failure rather than as change, and that's the thing I want to press upon. So for the time I have remaining, I just want to lay out my proposal for a new rule. I have so little time that you won't be able to see the objections. We'll leave that for the questions. I want to leave the basic norm of territorial integrity in place for cross-border aggressions. I'm all for the idea that we should prevent tanks crossing borders. But I want to relax it about one thing only, which is to give internal groups the power to make a claim against their own state to begin negotiations to exit. And they would do this through a process of plebiscites. And I modeled them on the plebiscites that were used quite successfully after the First World War to define borders between units. One of the big problems in self-determination is who gets to decide who the group is. And I try to solve this by a radical move to saying the group's going to define itself. Some population inside an existing state can make a claim to begin a process of exit, and they define the territorial limit of that group. They don't define themselves as a nation. It's a territory in which all the residents, all the citizens and non-citizens perhaps as well, have a right to vote. And if they reach a majority or a supermajority in that territory, they'd have a right to begin the process of negotiating their exit. This actually interestingly produces a kind of self-limiting strategy for such groups. You might think they'd claim as much territory as they want, but if you claim too much, you're going to have territories with populations that don't agree with you. We can see this in a place like Catalonia, for example. There are Catalan speakers not included in the project because it would make it impossible to get a majority. They have a hard enough time as it is. So the group's going to define its own territory and try to contest that in an election. I also allow a cascading model, again drawn from World War I, in which subgroups in that area could, if they can produce a majority in their smaller area, stay in the state that they're in. And by this, you get sort of a cascading effect where you can sort of precisely define a line, not by imposing it from the outside, but through a set of electoral choices by the individuals themselves, making preferences. The result is that a higher number of people will find themselves on the side of the line they might prefer, that is to say, in the community they wish to be a part of. Because time is short, I just want to note a few of the qualities I see of this. This is a model that is what I would call radically territorially democratic. It's focused on territory, but it's not based on some response to a harm like persecution or genocide. It's a right that you would claim because it's your desire as a political community. It's also very ahistorical. It's not focused on claims about justice because I observe that nobody agrees on those. Instead, it's focused on something we can measure and agree upon, an outcome in an election, that people on a day, for whatever reasons in their history, vote the way they do. That's how we treat normal elections. We don't ask people to explain why they voted for Biden or Trump. We just count up the votes. The history and the politics are the reasons behind that decision. This also means my model solves something that Professor Solomon mentioned that we are concerned about and that was a problem with Wilsonianism, which is we don't want to vindicate ethno-national identities for their own sake. And my model doesn't do that. It's actually anational. It doesn't require these communities to have any shared ethnicity. It requires only two things, that they live in some proximity to each other and that they make a choice in an election. Proximity and a vote, that's all it asks for. It's a very minimal shift in the rules, but I want to be honest, anyone who studied comparative law or politics knows tiny shifts make huge differences. This is a radical challenge to our existing system. I'm trying to minimize the scope of it, But the key thing to note is what I'm really aiming at is not to expect a large shift. I'm enough of a realist to think that such rules aren't likely to actually be vindicated. But it's about making a claim that gives a small amount of resources to minority groups to shift the balance of negotiations with the state, right? Because right now they've got basically no cards, and I want them to have like one, which is a claim in international law, much like human rights, that they could bring forward. So I'm at my time. There are many objections, and I want to hear from you about them in the Q&A. I just want to note one, which is this project too idealistic? I actually view it as a realist. It's my training. I'm as much a realist as anything else. And realism is about matching goals to means. And what I want to note here, again, is that my goal is quite marginal, to create a small bargaining advantage for minorities when they approach their own state. And I'll draw on one of the great realists, E.H. Carr, who reminds us that if you don't make models for peaceful change, you can expect the other kind. That's what I'm concerned with. And so I'll close by noting that however implausible my project is today, there's another very unrealistic view shaping our politics. That's the belief that borders can and should last forever, no matter what changes happen to the people inside them. But that's the current rule that we live under. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Professor Waters. We will now switch over to Professor Levinson, who is going to comment on both presentations.
Thank you. Both of these are terrific books, and I'm delighted at the invitation to participate and grateful to the two institutions that are sponsoring this. Let me go in order, beginning with Ilya's really terrific book, and I'll also say right now, Tim's book is really terrific. I want to begin with this cover and also the actually the acknowledgments, which I found very moving, about his own story of emigration from what was then the Soviet Union. My mother was an immigrant from Poland, and so that resonated with me very strongly. And there is much in this book that I can agree with, but needless to say, I have certain qualms. Let me start with the most fundamental agreement, which is that we overestimate the importance of the ballot box. I think, for example, of Rousseau's comment that the British were free only once every X years when they could actually vote for parliament. At that point, only about 10% of the British had the right to vote. Otherwise, they were living in what we might call a parliamentary dictatorship, assuming one puts to one side the claims of monarchs to rule independently of parliament. We can debate about alternatives to, let us say, the American fixation on fixed elections and only those elections. I'm much more taken than most of my professional colleagues are with the possibility of things like recall elections or initiatives and referenda, but that's orthogonal to the main discussion, because I think that Ilya is simply correct that under any system, under one's most idealized system of elections, the opportunity to vote with one's feet by walking away is an important component of individual freedom. So I congratulate him for making that argument in a very eloquent way. I think all of us have qualms about political regimes that attempt forcibly to prevent emigration, just as some of us might have qualms about religious institutions that, although they allow excommunication from the center, do not allow volitional resignation from the religious group, even if the basis of membership is birth, without any notion of assent to one's membership in that. The qualm. Ilya is, in my perspective, tied for first among academic libertarians in making really, really probing arguments based on a libertarian view. The problem I have with libertarianism is precisely its radical individualism, the tendency to lead to an almost parody form of Ec 101 economic men and women who ask only what's in it for me, and then ultimately to lead to the Holmesian bad man who also asks what's in it for me and has no other commitment. So this does lead ultimately to Margaret Thatcher's notable rejection of the very idea of society and of a serious commitment to what one might mean as the general welfare instead of one's individual welfare. Now, Ilya makes a number of arguments, which I think have to be taken very seriously, that open borders will in fact contribute to our general welfare, at least measured by economic growth and things like that. And I suspect he's right. It also contributes to what I regard as the very attractive notion of social diversity, of pluralism. But that obviously is a very controversial notion, that is the goodness or badness of diversity and pluralism, which is tearing apart our country right now. He says quite plausibly that his view is interestingly different or orthogonal from Albert Hirschman's emphasis on exit as an alternative to loyalty. But I think there is a family resemblance, that what the term voice and loyalty, I think, presupposes ultimately a genuine deep sense of felt membership in a group, for whatever reason, that will lead you to sacrifice your own individual utility, your own individual gains, to what you regard as your obligations to the larger society, to the good of the larger society. Ilya, like Thomas Hobbes, and I think that Hobbes is the greatest of all English-speaking political theorists, cannot explain really why a rational person would serve in the military. Certainly, if the military threatens your life, the point of the state is to provide security, and if you're going to lose your life for the state, that is not a good bet. Now, I don't want to go overboard. One day a week, I would define myself in some ways as a libertarian myself. I admire the Cato Institute. But the other days of the week, I have these fears about the society dissolving aspects of libertarianism. And as much as I resonate with this picture, for me, the central reality is that every one of these people, including my own mother, my own grandparents, rejected the old country, rejected a sense of commitment of loyalty. I'm glad they did, but it does smuggle in a certain notion of political obligation or lack of political obligations that I think needs more discussion. Now, on to Tim's book, which I also think is superb. I join him fully in saying that we need to think much more seriously about secession and the desirability of secession than we do. On my bookshelf right behind me, I have Richard Kreitner's new book called Break It Up, in which he basically advocates the breaking up of the United States. Ilya's colleague at Antonin Scalia, Frank Buckley, wrote a book in which for 80% of the pages, he seems to be advocating the breakup of the United States, and then says in the last 20%, no, not really. Given the current situation of the United States, where serious people are increasingly writing about the threat of civil war, I would much prefer a peaceful secessionism than a an ultra-violent civil war. So I think we really have to have the serious discussion that Tim is trying to provoke. I'm extremely confident that no thinking person supports every secessionist movement and no thinking person opposes every secessionist movement. The problem is that most thinking people don't think very deeply and seriously about secession. And what Tim's book does is to offer us the possibility of engaging in such thought. Now, I think, as he himself pointed out in his remarks, the most truly radical feature of his book is that he tries to distance the notion of secession from Wilsonian national self-determination. I view Woodrow Wilson as the most important and most mischievous figure of the 20th century, far more so than Lenin, who is dead. Woodrow Wilson, for better or worse, still lives in terms of the ideology of national self-determination. Now, for better and very much for worse, national tends to mean ethnicity, or it tends to mean the poster that Ilya was showing us, France for the French, and so on and so forth. I think that is really dangerous, and is, you know, the reason that a lot of us will oppose specific secession movements. On the other hand, I rather hope that Scotland secedes from the United Kingdom, partly because it's a very mild-mannered secessionist movement. It's the only secessionist movement I'm familiar with where foreign nationals living in Glasgow were allowed to vote, whereas Scottish nationals living in Birmingham were not allowed to vote because there was no notion of absentee voting. The Declaration of Independence, the preamble to the Constitution, and it's suitable on Constitution Day, we should actually look at both of those. The Declaration of Independence begins by asserting the existence of one people who were entitled to secede from the British Empire. It is preposterous to think that we were one people in 1776. Similarly, in 1787, it was preposterous to think that we were one people. And in a book that I wrote about the Federalists, I spend quite a bit of time on Federalist II, in which John Jay makes the preposterous argument that the glory is that Providence settled the New World with people who were basically all alike. Where do you begin in demonstrating the empirical falsity of that premise? But what is really interesting about Federalist II, or the Declaration of Independence, or the preamble, is the seeming necessity to assert that we're one people rather than an ungainly collection of peoples who are trying to figure out how to become a United States of America, which we've not yet really figured out to do. What Tim wants to do, as I say, is to limit as much as possible what I think are the empirical factors that generate secessionist movements, or that generate what we often call political loyalty. That is, senses of ethnic, national, religious, linguistic identity in favor of just those individuals who happen to occupy a certain territory at a certain time. In that sense, there is a link between Ilya and Tim in that both really want to talk about individuals rather than about groups. And what is both attractive and frightening about group membership, group loyalty, group solidarity, the idea that one wants to govern oneself as a group and then ultimately exclude others who are not part of the group. But let me conclude. I'm afraid I've probably gone a little bit over. Let me conclude by saying that these are both really, really terrific books that that vindicate what the Academy ought to be about, which is to encourage truly audacious ideas and to force the rest of us to confront their audacity and maybe even come to the conclusion that there is some merit in what we might begin by defining only as audacious and academic ideas in the pejorative sense of that term. So thank you.
Thank you, Professor Levinson. We will now have an opportunity for Professor Levinson, Professor Soman, and Professor Waters to talk together for about 12 to 15 minutes.
So I'd like to thank Tim for his excellent presentation and Sandy for his always insightful comments on these issues. I'd just like to briefly respond to a couple points that Sandy made, one about libertarianism, the other about social ties and commitments. While I am, of course, libertarian, have to plead guilty to that. It's too late in my career for me to pretend otherwise. I deliberately wrote this book in such a way that it doesn't rely on any specific libertarian principles or premises. That is, there's no reliance on any idea of absolute property rights or any idea that redistribution should be forbidden or any idea that individuals should only be considered to pursue their own self-interest. That latter, by the way, is not actually a libertarian idea, though it is one that is sometimes associated with libertarianism by others, but it's not an assumption that I make in the book or one that I actually believe in. So the premises that I build the book on are general liberal premises, which include varieties of left liberalism in the book. Particularly in chapter one, I discuss how most of what I argue for follows from theories of political freedom developed by such people as John Rawls, non-domination theorists and others, very few, if any, of whom can be considered libertarians. I also discussed the consent theory of the legitimacy of government, which is associated with libertarians, but also with many other kinds of liberal thinkers as well. Further, I discuss how even for people who are not self-interested in the narrow sense of the term, foot voting can greatly expand their opportunities, both to improve the lot of their families, but also to improve the lot of society. You can improve it more if you move to an area where you have greater opportunities, are more productive, and so forth. Finally, I don't want to go too far into the issue of how my view is different from Albert Hirschman's. That itself could take up an entire book. But one way in which it's different is that Hirschman, who was not a libertarian, worried that if exit is too easy, that will undermine social ties and commitments, and it will prevent people from investing in the institutions where they already are. So that was his concern about school choice, for example, that if people might leave the public schools and the public schools would be undermined, particularly sort of the potentially most active or most useful parental contributors might leave. What I point out is that when people have more freedom of choice over what institutions they're going to be a part of, they can find ones that meet their preferences better and meet their needs better, and therefore they'll actually have more of an incentive to invest because there's a better match between their institutions and what they're looking for. I cite various kinds of empirical data which support this, including the empirical data on school choice, which suggests that more choice actually greatly increases the quality of institutions in an area. And similarly, when you look at local governments from which exit is easier because there are more of them in a particular area, there tends to be also more investment of various kinds in local institutions, including political institutions, I think because there's a better match between the people in a given area and the types of institutions that are there. One analogy that I think is overused, but I do look at it in the book, is the analogy between marriage and choice of political institutions. Both common sense and actually some social science data that I cite suggest that people invest more in their marriages when they are able to choose the partner that they're going to marry, as opposed to when it's dictated to them by society or arranged marriages and the like. People have happier marriages when they can choose and they invest more in them. And I think the same thing is true of governments and societies and the like. I also finally in the book do address a wide range of arguments which say that migration can be limited not at the behest of the society that you enter, but at the behest of the society that you leave. The thing that Sandy was alluding to when he said, well, the people who went to America, they were in a sense rejecting the society that they left. In the case of his, I guess it was your parents, of Poland, in the case of me and my parents, Russia, and so forth. And I criticize arguments which say that the society you're born into has some kind of presumptive claim on your loyalty, that they can force you to stay and perhaps even force you to work for the society. Finally, on the military, I think there are totally rational reasons why a person in my framework could join the military, so long as it's not coerced. So I oppose the military draft. On the other hand, there are opportunities in the military, and you might join it out of idealism as well. I would urge that if you join out of idealism, it should be out of the idealism about the principles of liberty and justice that a particular army is defending, rather than loyalty to a particular government or a particular ethnic group for its own sake.
I'll just jump in. Sandy, thanks so much for your excellent comments. The one thing that really struck me, you mentioned, you know, sort of the dangers of this, you know, ever-living Wilsonianism. I totally agree. I'm reading Kissinger's opus on diplomacy right now. And one of his themes is that every American administration since then has been fundamentally Wilsonian in important ways. His influence is tremendous. And I agree that it's problematic. You know, I'm very much criticizing the current model that we have of territorial integrity, but I don't want to go back to his, because I agree the focus, sort of the arrogant assumption that we're going to describe ethno-national groups and give them territory is morally problematic and politically dangerous. I guess what I'm trying to reach at is some place where we acknowledge that people have those desires, and how do we frame them in the state in a safe and peaceful and just way? Because ethno-national groups are dangerous. The ultimate group that's dangerous is the state itself, often. This is a group that we need to interrogate. And indeed, often that's why ethno-national groups want exit, because they're in someone else's ethno-national state. So one reason we need to think about those occasional good secessions is that. Maybe there's one thing I want to stress about this. I try to keep my model as limited as possible. It's entirely possible to add to it sort of normative features. If we want to limit the turn towards ethno-nationalism, we can say that claimant groups have to respect certain kinds of rights and so forth. So that would be consistent with the model. The main thing I want to aim at, though, I want to somehow acknowledge that people have these identities and values, and not just individuals. I agree with that as well. They exist in societies, part of which is ethnic, linguistic, religious identities that matter to people in politics. And what I'm aiming for is to sort of normalize that in a safe way, where we're no longer thinking about nationalism, but what we might call national states. That is to say, states in which rights are respected, identities and diversities are respected, but the normal operation of politics yields outcomes that some group is okay with. In the way that, like, modern Germany is a very non-nationalist state, but it has very national outcomes. The president speaks German. Germans dominate society in normal ways because of majoritarian politics. That's what I'm aiming at. And secession allows people to gain the advantages of majoritarianism without overt appeals to nationalism. Anyway, it's a great point. I really appreciate it. And it's exactly what I'm trying to get at, is some way to thread between these two very unpleasant possibilities.
Yeah, if I can pick up at that for a moment, I think we often just naturally use the term nation state. And as political scientists, we should ask, well, what are the conditions of being both a nation and a state at the same time? Iceland, I think, probably is a nation state.
That's about it, yeah.
But, you know, I think you're absolutely right about Germany, which is astonishing given the history of the last 100 years. I don't believe the United States is a nation state. I don't think it ever has been a nation state. But as I try to say in my remarks, I think that it is interesting to see how desperate Thomas Jefferson was, or John Jay was, or other figures, sometimes attractive, sometimes decidedly unattractive, have tried to give a national aspect to being American, as against our being you know, whether you want to call, well, a mosaic of, you know, cultural pluralism. Like, with regard to Ilya's point, without taking a side on this, Michael Sandel wrote his first book criticizing John Rawls basically on ontological grounds. That is to say that Rawls and the notion of the veil of ignorance and the notion of rational choice behind the veil of ignorance basically presupposed a radical individualism where you really are trying to think through how can I best flourish when the veil is lifted up. Sandel, rightly or wrongly, defended a much more communitarian ontology where you are thrust into, you are embedded into communities, really whether you want to or not, whether you like it or not, but lo and behold, it turns out that they constitute your identity in some important sense, and therefore, ultimately, your sense of obligations. So I think Ilya is absolutely right that he is drawing, or can legitimately draw on Rawls. All I would say is that from purposes of my comment, Rawls is indeed much closer to the camp of radical individualists than he is of ontological communitarians.
Yeah, I think that's fair that, as I say, actually in the book, I draw on liberalism generally, which is not the same thing as libertarianism specifically. Libertarianism is a sub-variant of liberalism. Yeah. So somebody who rejects liberalism categorically will reject a lot of my arguments. Though I also have sections where I, at least implicitly, take issue with a lot of the assumptions of communitarianism about particular ethnic and cultural groups and how they operate and the like. The very fact that there are many millions of people that want to leave their cultural or community group that they were born into and go somewhere else is a sign that there's something seriously flawed in Sandel's viewpoint and I think in communitarianism generally.
Oh, I agree with you. I think that one of the things that all academics learn to do fairly quickly in their careers is to point out the strengths and weaknesses of liberalism and the strengths and weaknesses of communitarianism. And then they spend the rest of their lives feeling torn about which to opt for under which circumstances. So that's why I say quite seriously, you know, there are times when I feel very attracted to libertarian arguments, and then other times where I want to run away from them because I do think there is, you know, what one might call a social psychological tendency to go down the road toward Holmes's bad man. I agree that's not necessarily logically entailed, but I do think it is a tendency that I want to warn against. On the other hand, I certainly think there are problems with communitarianism that you point out.
Are we ready for some questions?
Sure.
This is a question from Ted from UC Santa Barbara. Decentralization seems to sometimes limit movement. For example, local land use controls and state level occupational licensure. Do we need a semi-constitutional central rule limiting some types of local decision making?
It's a good question, and my answer is yes. Both in this book and even more so in some of my previous work, which deals with property rights, I talk about how some types of local control are objectionable from a foot voting framework, either because they explicitly exclude people, and we have a history of that in this country of states, for instance, trying to exclude even free blacks, or in some cases exclude poor people, or because the implicit effect of, for instance, zoning restrictions and occupational licensing laws and the like is to make it difficult or impossible for people to move. So I have both in this book and in previous work urged constitutional constraints and those kinds of local or state exclusion. I also suggest that in a foot voting framework, I think foot voting works extremely well for protecting assets that are mobile, and therefore it can work especially well for the relatively poor and disadvantaged who have relatively little in the way of valuable immobile assets like property and land, but something like land cannot be moved and therefore which should require more constitutional protection against state or local exploitation. Finally, both in this book and elsewhere, I point out that creating that kind of protection, in one sense, it limits decentralization because it limits state and local governments. But in another sense, it actually heightens it because, for instance, if you protect property rights against zoning restrictions or eminent domain or other kinds of constraints, the decision making is left in the hands of the property owner and the people he or she deals with. And that actually is a greater degree of decentralization than leaving it in the hands of the state government or of the local government. So I discuss some of this at considerable length in chapter 7 of this book. I also have a previous article that I published in 2011 called Federalism and Constitutional Property Rights, which goes into the question of how decentralization and constitutional protection for property rights can be better reconciled. It was in the U of Chicago Legal Forum.
Thank you. Here's a question for Professor Waters. Are there limits to the minimum size of a seatable region? Can my family vote to create a new state on my lot? And then I will ask a similar question from Stephanie. Would your model apply to internal borders, such as state borders within the U.S.?
Good questions, both. Very interesting. The first one, you can try to vote, but part of the point is you got to win a vote, right? And mm-hmm. and I do indeed imagine some minimums here. No minimum size, because there actually are very small states that are highly functional. I don't place a limit there, but I do propose a limit on population, that there should be some minimum population to avoid the family country problem. This is a thing. So the place where we find in academia people most interested in secessions in political philosophy, it's really rare in law and political science, but lots of political philosophers, even if they're attracted to the idea, they start to say, look, there's no logical limit. Once we identify the reasons why people ought to be able to secede, we're down to individuals. And for some, this is a reason to abandon the model. I have a very different approach to that, which is that this is a place where lawyers are good at solving the problem by introducing, frankly, arbitrary limits. So in the book, I suggest a minimum of, say, 1 million people in the territory that you have to win a supermajority in. It could be 5, it could be 2. There's no actual philosophical justification for that number, but law and life in general are filled with fairly arbitrary decisions. And what this one does is ensure that we've got a sizable group, that it's not just a rent-seeking individual with a particular circumstance or a warlord, that the higher the number of people, the more likely we are to be confident that this is actually representing some legitimate political desire. So it's just a question of where you place that limit. The higher it is, the fewer groups and individuals will benefit. The lower, the more we get to the problem of these are very small groups. But that's my response, in a sense, is to place limits like that, not on territory, but on population. So if you got a big enough family, or more importantly, if you can convince enough of your neighbors to join your project, you can do it. But you're going to have to convince a large number of people. The second question, Paula, was, remind me again, this is about internal borders, right?
Would your model apply to internal borders, such as state borders within the U.S.?
So it certainly could. I don't address that a lot. I do look at a few internal examples from Switzerland, for example, for the mechanics of how this could work. They're quite informative. There are places in Switzerland that have used multiple cascading decisions, elections to determine internal cantonal borders. But I don't address the internal mostly because this is really a question about whether or not a state ought to exist. And I'm fairly agnostic about its internal qualities. It could be democratic, monarchical, many things. I'm only focused on the question of how would we understand and operationalize exit from that group if some community, from that state, if some community wanted to? So you could apply these principles internally. I just don't consider that question, but the mechanics would work very well domestically.
Actually, let me suggest for the legal academics in the audience, I feel very embarrassed about the fact that I have never taught a course in state and local government. But it seems to me that the question cashes out with regard to annexation and de facto secession policy within states that happens with some regularity. And I know just enough to know that annexation law can be extremely controversial, Austin, Texas, vis-a-vis the suburbs. And one reads in the newspapers with modest frequency of Staten Island wishing to secede from the larger New York City, or, you know, other movements of that sort. So there is, I presume, some worked out legal doctrines as to when people can be forced into association, or those circumstances where they can achieve some degree of home rule and self-determination on matters of zoning policy or education policy or whatever.
Thank you. Here's a question for Professor Soman. Could a right of secession also lead to a greater risk of quote unquote othering minority groups in multi-ethnic nation states?
I'm not sure if that's entirely a question for me or for Tim, so why don't I speak briefly and Tim can comment on it as well. But yes, I think I actually agree with about 70 or 80% of what Tim says in his excellent book. But this is one point on which I have more reservations, and I expressed them more fully in the Balkanization blog symposium on Tim's book that Sandy Levinson helped organize. But here I'll merely say that while Tim, I think, is absolutely right that it might be desirable to have a secession framework that's neutral as to race, ethnicity, culture, and so forth, in reality, a very high percentage of secession movements, the American Revolution is a major historical exception, but a very high percentage are actually ethno-nationalist in nature. So often there is the risk that you create a new ethno-nationalist state, which will then oppress the new minority within its own borders, also potentially try to keep out or even expel people who don't belong to that group. So I don't think that means that we should forbid or have a secession or have a strong presumption against it. I do think, however, that there needs to be stronger institutional constraints to guard against the creation of new oppressive states, to guard against things like what the Confederacy would have been had it succeeded in making good its secession, a state devoted, in this case, to oppression by means of slavery. But there are other kinds of oppression as well that could be done. And so that might mean that secession could be allowed only if the resulting state meets certain human rights criteria. I would argue this would be more controversial. It should also only be allowed if the resulting state maintains freedom of movement, both in terms of letting existing residents leave, but also in terms of letting new residents enter. And that way, we can potentially even integrate my proposal and Tim's, in that allowing secession enables the creation of more options for foot voters to potentially choose from, but allowing free exit and entry also makes it less likely that either the new state or the old one will in fact be oppressive.
Yeah, I'll just add, so this, I think the question is directed to me. Otherwise, I'll just add to that. Could it lead to a greater risk? Yes, I think the key thing here is greater, right? It's important to recognize we already live in a world in which there is considerable risk of othering minority groups. For me, the concern is that risk already exists in a world in which there is no possibility to escape from it realistically. So I think it's true. It probably might increase the risk on the margins. It's hard to measure, but I acknowledge that's true. One thing this allows me to point out, I'm not talking about some perfect model. My model, if it were actually instantiated, would be an extremely dangerous and violent world. I'm just trying to imagine one that would be degrees less dangerous and violent than the one we currently live in. That's got to be the test, not some test of perfection. So we already have a very dangerous world. And one thing to note here, I think it's implicit in the question, as I mentioned, one of our assumptions is These secession groups might produce illiberal ethno-national communities, as if that's not already the case. So Ilya's right. Most of the groups that would take advantage of the rule are probably ethno-national in identity. This is predictable, because that's the way people organize themselves on territory. They don't organize territorially by class or gender or others, but language, religion, these are the predictable factors that explain human populations on territory. It's also true for existing ones. So a new ethno-national state is also a group escaping, in many cases, an existing one. I did a lot of my work on Yugoslavia. You know, the new state of Kosovo is highly ethno-national in many respects. It is overwhelmingly Kosovo-Albanian. It's got many nationalist features. And it escaped from a state that had those same kinds of features and was even more violent and dangerous by a long shot. So we're not looking at good choices, but moderately less bad ones. The last thing I would note is there's an important, even with this risk that you advert to in your question, new states are very vulnerable. They need a lot of diplomatic support. So there's an incredibly important moment of leverage. When a claimant state tries to come into existence and seek recognition, that's when other states can say the kinds of things Ilya and Sandy both mentioned, we'll expect certain behaviors. We need you to sign certain treaties, commit to certain kinds of activities. That's actually much easier to do with a new state than an existing one. So the moment of secession is actually a moment of maximum leverage to shape that new society. But it's true. These are dangerous moments, and many of the groups will be kinds that we won't like. That's the reality that describes many of the actors that hold states today.
If I can jump in for 30 seconds, if my fantasy of Pacifican secession were to take place, it would be on the basis of a basically Waters sort of notion of wildly diverse people who have no shared national identity, rejecting what they would describe as an ethno-nationalist conception of country instantiated in Trumpism.
Thank you. Let's move to another question. This is from Furhan. Generally, territory is the most contentious factor in cases of secessions. For example, Sudan and South Sudan, Iraq and Kurdistan. How can opposing contentions be reconciled?
With great difficulty. I guess my entire project is to acknowledge that in the current model, there is no mechanism for doing this. And if anything, in fact, the legal, diplomatic, and political cards are all stacked against it. And I'd like to find some way to make that slightly more plausible for such groups. This is mostly about territory and power, absolutely. And so, again, I'm not actually anticipating that if my rule were to meet with even a modicum of success, that it would lead to free secessions around the world. States would resist this. I'm thinking this much more in the way people think of a human rights project, where you don't actually expect performance and you have no mechanism for enforcement. But nonetheless, the theory is, and it's a plausible one, that the existence of these norms helps empower certain actors domestically to make claims, to find allies abroad. Some states will take up their cause and do so more effectively because it has a claim in law and rights. So you're creating this marginal advantage, you know, 0.1% better odds than attempting the exit and the territorial change in the current system, which gives you nothing. So that's what I'm trying to describe, a slightly less difficult process for exiting.
Any other comments there? Okay, we'll move on to another question. How are borders around the world violating the rights of asylum seekers from persecution? And what role should we expect from richer countries like the United States?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I devote a large part of chapter 8 of my book to the issue of asylum and refugee rights. And here I have both a radical proposal and a much more incremental one. My radical proposal is that we should replace the current presumption under which states have a general right to exclude people unless those people meet some kind of specific type of exception with the opposite presumption, that instead there should be a general presumption of freedom of movement and states would only have the right to exclude in situations where they prove that there's some great harm that would be avoided by excluding the person and where a keyhole solution is not feasible and where they cannot use the wealth created by migration to address the problem. So I would require them to go through the three-step framework that I outlined earlier. However, I do recognize that as with Tim's proposal, Tim says probably correctly that it's not likely to be fully adopted in the near future. The same thing is true for mine. So there are many incremental improvements that can be made that would still make a huge difference. So if the US, for instance, would just take 10% more immigrants per year, that's 100,000 or more people every year that can trade poverty and oppression for greater freedom. And the same thing is true for other wealthier nations. I also discussed the specifics of refugee and asylum law. We're under the current system. People have a presumptive right not to be expelled if they're fleeing certain particular types of oppression, like persecution on the basis of their political views, their religion, their race, gender, possibly one or two other categories. I propose incrementally expanding them to, for example, include everyone who is fleeing at least particularly oppressive regimes, nations like Cuba, Venezuela, and North Korea, and others, where the government severely oppresses almost everyone who lives there, regardless of whether they're an open dissident or whether they belong to a particular ethnic or religious group. I also propose cutting back the distinction between so-called political refugees who have been persecuted in one of these ways and quote-unquote economic refugees, because many of these sorts of governments, the reason why people are fleeing them for quote-unquote economic reasons is because the government policy is so oppressive that it makes it almost impossible for most of the people in that society to escape poverty. That is certainly the case in the regimes that I mentioned, but also in quite a few others. So that you can take this further and point out, as I also do in the book, that for the one-third or so of the world's population that lives in societies that are dictatorships, they have no political freedom at all, other than perhaps the ability to exercise choice by leaving the country entirely. So maybe living in a dictatorship should be automatically considered a form of political oppression, which entitles you to refugee status. And all of these reforms, they can be implemented all together, but they can also be implemented separately, and any one of them can make a significant incremental difference.
I think we have time for one last question. This was directed to Professor Waters. Is there any concern over Berlin situations where a minority in a large state is able to accrue outsized power by virtue of the fact that they happen to control a small region that contains a valuable or sensitive resource?
A great question, and one that pertains to economics, how appropriate for the center. So partly I've answered this by saying I don't place limits on size, but on population. So if you're a large enough population in an area, but this goes to an important feature on trying to keep this minimal change in our current system. Like it might be unfair to say, oh, if you're living on top of a gold mine, you and a million of your best friends can vote to exit and be wealthy and strip that wealth from the rest of the country. But that's a logic that assumes that country is a morally relevant unit. And that's the very thing we're contesting. It's worth noting, in the current system, the one we live in now, not my model, there is zero obligation for states to share wealth across their borders. If you've got the oil, you get to keep it. You get to exploit it. That's not a function of morality. That's a function of existing borders. All I'm suggesting is if otherwise have reasons to change borders because of oppression or political desire, then we follow the rules of saying, okay, each state takes the territorial resources that it has, right? So we shouldn't work this backwards. In other words, if we're concerned about this problem, it's a problem for the existing system as well, and it's actually a far more radical critique than the one I'm making, because it's an argument for global redistribution of resources and wealth. One can argue that, but that's an even bigger challenge than what I'm proposing, which is to apply the existing rules and allow for new states to form within that system.
I can't resist adding that to the extent that we're concerned with the global distribution of wealth and that the unfairness that, you know, some people live on top of a large amount of oil or a gold mine and others don't, empirically, the best means we have of opening up opportunities for the poorest people in the world is in fact to give them freedom of movement to migrate to wealthier areas. That actually works much better at uplifting people than foreign aid does, than trying to require wealthier nations to give money to poorer ones, where all too often what happens is the elites in the poorer nations or the governments capture the wealth from the foreign aid, take it for themselves, and there's little or no benefits to the general population. Whereas freedom of movement can very quickly have truly enormous benefits, both for the people who actually get to move, but even for their relatives back home who often get remittances from their relatives in wealthier nations. For instance, a country like El Salvador, some 20 or 30% of its national income is remittances from Salvadorans living in the U.S., but who have family members in El Salvador and they send money back. That's a much better anti-poverty program and a much more effective one than anything the U.S. government is likely to be able to do, for example, by giving El Salvador foreign aid. And the same thing is true for many other poor countries around the world.
Well, thank you very much. And we have come to the end of our webinar. Thank you, Professor Selman, Professor Waters, Professor Levinson. I also want to thank Dean Parrish for being with us today. Thanks to all of our attendees for participating today. We hope you enjoyed the webinar. To learn more about the Law and Economics Center and to view a list of our upcoming events, please visit us at masonlec.org. We hope you can all join us again soon. Have a good day, everyone.